Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins. For many who are new to North Carolina, Rufus Edmiston's name may not ring a bell, but for one of the most momentous times in our nation's modern history, Rufus was at the center of it all. When the Senate Special Committee on Watergate subpoenaed President Richard Nixon for his Oval Office tapes, it was Edmiston who served the White House with the subpoena, the first time a sitting U.S. president had been served. And yet it was more than just that subpoena that Edmiston had seen in the politics of the nation and of his native North Carolina. A former Attorney General of the state, Secretary of State, and the Democratic Party's nominee for governor in 1984, Rufus Edmiston's impact on North Carolina politics stretches over 40 years, and he captures that time in a new book entitled That's Rufus, a memoir of Tar Heel politics, Watergate, and public life. And Rufus Edmiston joins us for the hour from the studios of WUNC in Durham. Welcome to Charlotte Talks, Rufus.
Thank you, Michael. I really love UNC system.
Great.
Public radio.
Good to have you on. If you want to join our conversation about Watergate or North Carolina politics, send us an email at charlottetalks@wfae.org. You can find us on Facebook, or you can send us a tweet at Charlotte Talks. Rufus, I want to start our conversation as you start your book with that fateful moment of having to deliver a subpoena from the U.S. Senate to the President of the United States. And you write that it was hot in D.C. that day and that you were surrounded by reporters and Capitol Hill police officers as you walked up to the White House. And actually, you did more than just hand over the subpoena for the tapes that the president refused to hand over. What else did you give to the White House?
Oh, my goodness, Michael. It was one of the hottest days in the world, and it was hot in more ways than one. Washington is probably the most humid place in the world. But it was hot because we were doing something that, as you mentioned, hadn't been done before. And after I had given my little mini speech about the purpose of my visit under Senate resolution to subpoena the White House, I happened to remember that in my back pocket, Michael, I had one of those little blue constitutions that Senator Irvin used to wave around and use all the time at the hearings. And I thought, well, here you are. You just as well do it. I had this little impish desire. I whipped that little blue subpoena out and said, you know, you might want to need one of these down here, too, while you're at it, so I want to hereby give you this subpoena. And the subpoena in the form of the U.S. Constitution. And that's something a little boy that's 32 years old from the mountains would do, but I'm glad I did it, and it was a fun thing, and I think they took it in the spirit that it was given.
What kind of reaction did you and the committee expect from the subpoena for the tapes?
Well, we didn't expect them to stonewall as much as they would. The previous to the subpoena being delivered, as I chronicled in the book, Michael, the senator had tried to speak with the president. Mm-hmm. And asked the president to voluntarily give up the tapes. And there's a little side story there, as you might remember in the book,
yeah,
where I said something that...
Well, when the president came on the line, you were on the line, and you said what?
Well, when the president came on the line, I wasn't expecting the president. I was expecting his secretary, the 18-minute gap famed lady, to get back on the line, and here was this voice that said, well, Senator Irvin, this is Richard Nixon. And remember, all the time, President Nixon had been saying that the committee was out to get him. Right. And I blurted out, oh, Mr. President, Senator Irvin wants to get you on the phone, sir. I mean, on the phone, please forgive me. So there I went for my faux pas of the day there and went back and told the committee later in session that day, and I thought they would roll in the floor until they got sick. They thought it was so funny that I had told the president that the senator was out to get him. that I meant on the phone.
Gotcha, gotcha. You worked for the Democratic U.S. Senator Sam Ervin and wrote that the senator was the greatest teacher to you. Both of you were raised in rural North Carolina, but you and the senator both had an intellect for the political process. How did that play out in Washington in the early 1970s?
Well, back in those days, Michael, I can give you an example of how there was more than 35-second sound bites. One time, Senator Ervin was on the floor of the Senate, and he was talking about prayer in the schools and separation of church and state. And Senator Wayne Morris of Oregon had heard Senator Ervin's talk, and I never forget it. I was sitting there on the floor with the senator. Senator Morris came up and said, Sam, I heard your speech, and I want you to know as a result of hearing your speech, I've changed my mind. I'm not going to vote for that prayer in the school amendment because you've explained what it means. Well, there was a kind of comity back then, a kind of gentlemanliness that doesn't exist today. And an upbringing in the mountains where we came from, you were taught to listen more than talk. My mother always used to say, if you're talking, you're not listening. And those days, I'm afraid, are over in the sense that sides seem to be talking and ugly to one another at all times rather than listening. So it's a different era. The era that I remember and I talk about in that book so much is one long forgotten, and I hope that people will read it and think of that there is a possibility that those times can exist if people have goodwill. And if it has to come from the top, though. I've often said that the only reason the Watergate hearings succeeded, and they're one of the few that have succeeded on Capitol Hill in a long time, was because Senator Ervin and Senator Baker willed that it would happen that way. They both decided from the very beginning that these hearings would work and that Senator Ervin and Senator Baker would not make any major policy decisions without both of them agreeing on it. And so you can work that way, and I hope that the book conveys to people that that is possible even in these days of turmoil and hateful statements on the side on both sides.
Right. You talked about the fact that Senator Ervin was the chair. The ranking member was Senator Howard Baker of nearby Tennessee. Talk a little bit about how the two of them really reached across the aisle, worked with both of them in this very heated and very controversial issue of Watergate.
Well, you mentioned it, that they both came from similar backgrounds, Senator Baker being from East Tennessee and Senator Ervin, Western North Carolina. And they could almost anticipate one another's next words. You could tell it. And they joke quite a bit. There's several pictures of Watergate where the two senators are laughing out loud just as hard as they can laugh because they could tell jokes. They knew how to talk to one another, and it made things work, because they both decided that it would work because they knew that was the gentlemanly thing to do. You couldn't have had a better operational head of the committee than the two of them. And they worked like what I called a team of horses, in step. Nobody broke out of the Haynes. And they both knew one another as gentlemen is how I like to describe it. The euphemism that the Senate is a club of gentlemen was true then, and I'm afraid we've lost all that now, Michael.
Where do you think that gentlemanliness of the Senate was lost?
It was lost with talk radio and talk television, of the extreme polls, the outlandish radio programs on both sides. I think it sort of started when Nixon had his Southern strategy. That's when we had people getting real riled up about things and seeming to have hateful words for one another. It seemed to have started about the time that Nixon ran his first campaign and developed what we call the Southern strategy. And then it's morphed on now with television and radio into warring camps. Right now, if you look at the Republican Party, there's one party now. It is totally the party of Donald Trump. And, of course, here are the Democrats with Pharaoh's army running. I don't know how many more there are today. Over 25 yesterday. And it is a sight to behold.
You write that Senator Ervin saw Richard Nixon as somebody who preferred himself to be more like a king than a president. Did that shape the way that the senator went about holding the Watergate hearings?
I think it definitely did, because Senator used to say to me in those long trips we would take where I was driving him that Richard Nixon was afraid of freedom. And I said, well, Senator, what do you mean by that? He said, well, he has this notion that we brought the monarchy over to America with us. And he did say on an interview one time with, I think it was David Frost.
David Frost, yeah.
That if the president does it, it's not against the law. I mean, my gosh, I think I've heard that repeated in the past two or three days, too, on the part of a current president we have. I'm not getting partisan here, but I think history repeats itself. And I've often said that the Trump administration needs to go back and thoroughly, thoroughly study the Watergate era if they really want to not repeat the mistakes of the past. And I know that over half of America wasn't even born when Watergate went to occur, but there are a lot of good lessons there. And if I had one gift that I could give to the Trump administration, it would be go back and have all your people read the summaries of the Watergate hearings and find out just really what happened, and don't repeat it.
Okay. You interviewed many of the individuals involved in Watergate before they made their public testimony before the Senate committee, including the acting director of the FBI, and you write that you felt sorry for the president's aides. Why?
Well, I remember one time we were interviewing John Mitchell, the attorney general under Nixon. And he was in my office, in fact, in the executive committee. That's like lawyers never ask a question of someone unless you know what the answer is going to be. Well, that's why we had executive sessions before they went public. And the man was sitting there just shaking. He was just so visibly and emotionally upset. And he tried to light his pipe, and he couldn't do it, Michael. And I said, well, Mr. Attorney General, do you mind if I try to help you? So he nodded his head yes, and I cuffed his hand in mine, held his pipe, and helped him get it up to his mouth, and I had the lighter there. And he got his pipe lit, and he looked up to me with the most sorrowful eyes, and he said, young man, that was such a nice thing to do. And I thought, how about having a little bit of that while this is going on, that these are lives that have been turned upside down, and the truth of it is that we're turned upside down from people who should not have been. Almost all of them came from good, solid families, good middle-class, upper-middle-class families. They had the best of educations. They were lawyers and political scientists. There were people who were highly educated, and, you know, here were burglars all dressed in suits, believe it or not, to broke into the Watergate complex. And I remember interviewing Patrick Gray one time, and I kept saying to myself, how in the world did you get yourself in this fix that you've had everything in life that's good, and yet you got caught up in this worship of Richard Nixon? And it took them all down because they wanted to prove so much to get his favor.
We're talking with Rufus Edmiston about his Watergate experience. This is Charlotte Talks. We'll be back after this break.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
And welcome back to Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins, and we're talking with Rufus Edmiston about his new book, That's Rufus, A Memoir of Tar Heel Politics, Watergate, and Public Life. And we were talking before the break about the sense of humanity that you had experienced during the Watergate controversy. It was probably one of the critical moments in American history. Some described it as the precept of a constitutional crisis. But I want to get to a point that I think you were making before the break and ask the question, have we lost a sense of humanity in politics that seemed to be present during that time period?
We were beginning to lose it then. I think back in North Carolina when I think it first began eroding here is the year that Skipper Bowles ran for governor and didn't quite make it. It was happening in the 70s, there's no question about it. But today, it is though we have a coliseum and you set the lions loose on the poor victims. And the victims are the voting public of the country that have to be subjected to all this crass bitterness that's pent up. And I have a notion too, Michael, that so much of this has come up from the industry called the political consulting business. Now, a lot of my friends, just like you have, are in that business, and I don't mean to pigeonhole them all and say that they're all bad people. They're not. But it has become so common today for political consultants to say, go for the gut juggler. Go kill them, kill them, kill them. Mm-hmm. That bothers me so tremendously. And a lot of political consultants will get on a TV show or a talk show afterwards and say, I won this race and I won that race. And sometimes I want to grab them and shake them a little bit and say, look, you didn't win anything. The candidate there won or lost. And you were supposed to be an agent of to get them to the ultimate goal of winning. And I think that the new industry of political consulting has added to this lack of civility. And it is lost. I'm sad to say it's lost because once you get a bite into it, I know the old thing, we've said it just like you have a million times. We don't like them, but they seem to work. The terrible ads.
The negative ads.
Yeah, they seem to work. And I ran a total of 11 times, and most of the time I wasn't into that business because the race wasn't high profile enough, like Attorney General, Secretary of State. But when I got to be governor, they wanted me to attack. Right. And I just refused to do it. And I will say one thing about my friend Governor Jim Martin. I have nothing but praise for that gentleman. I don't think, Michael, that he ever ran an ugly ad against me. Now, I must say Eddie Knox did in the primary.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't believe that Governor Jim Martin ever said an ugly thing about me. He was just a perfect gentleman. And it was so ironic that when I was elected Secretary of State that I served with the guy who beat me.
Yeah.
And you can run races if you can somehow separate the political consultants. It is possible to run a race not devoid of the hateful speech, but almost devoid of it if you could keep the political consultants from practicing their profession for a little while.
You left the Senate in 74, came back to the state to run for attorney general. Compare that to what you see in campaigning today. What was campaigning like in those days?
Well, it was sort of like when Senator Irvin and I used to campaign. His last campaign was in 1968, and I call it the courthouse form of campaigning. We'd get in that old Chrysler car of his and go rocking down the road, and we'd go from courthouse to courthouse. You'd see the sheriff, the clerk of court, the register of deeds, the tax collector, the whole crowd. Then that night you would have a rally in that county, and that's how you campaigned. It was a sort of gentle way of campaigning back in those days. And not like today. Now, when I campaigned for governor, I think I shook about every available hand in North Carolina. I remember one time going over to Durham, and I don't think I mentioned this in the book. If I did, I should have. I didn't. Somebody on my staff, and I think it was that wonderful Charlie Smith, who's a Charlotte native, who was my campaign manager, had me in a chicken rendering plant where they cut up chickens over in Durham. And there I go walking in there, and I couldn't quite figure out, you know, I'm a farm boy. I've been around a lot of butchering and this and that.
Right.
But I walked in there, and here I had a suit on, and I saw this man looking at me with the most hateful, despicable look in the world, as though here you are, you fancy little suited up B-A-S-T-A-R-D. And I knew what was going to happen, Michael. I knew that man was going to try to get me to shake his hand. He had on those steel gloves.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, here he comes toward me with just steel in his eyes and steel in his hands. And he grabs my hand, and he squeezed it within an inch of life.
Oh.
And the blood started oozing, and so we got me immediately over to Durham General Hospital to make sure that we didn't have any tetanus or anything like that. But it just showed how far I would go to get a vote. And my advice, stay away from chicken cutting rendering plants when you're running for office. And now nobody does that. In fact, I go into campaign offices now, and I have heard campaigners say, now, if we can't have a fundraiser there, we're not going. Now, that's a sad thing in America today when you say you're not going to go visit someplace unless you can have a fundraiser. I think a wise politician would try to move back a little bit more to neighborhood gatherings, mm-hmm. shaking hands, greeting people at all sorts of forums, because I think people are so tired of just seeing TV and the ads. They're already starting. I heard some and saw some this morning. I have a notion that the person that can know how to wisely use their dollars, mix the campaign money for some smart TV ads with a lot of personal touch. I know that some of the presidential campaigns are trying to do that, but the country's too big for that. But in North Carolina, right. you can still pretty well cover the state in a modest way by doing that. And I think campaigning personal is coming back. And if I were to ever run another one, which I do not, Michael, I do not intend to ever do.
So we have it on the record that you will not run.
No,
okay.
No, I will not run. Because I have been there, done that, and like to help other people now. But I think it's a time for some more kind of hands-on, retail politics.
Right, right. Almost human. Get back into the human nature of the modern campaigning process. Let me ask you, when you were elected to AG, you faced a number of issues, one of which was probably the most controversial issues during your time as Attorney General for the state of North Carolina, and that was with the Wilmington 10. And for those folks who aren't familiar with that, it was following a police shooting of a young African-American man during a demonstration regarding school integration, or the lack thereof, in Wilmington. Several fires were set to downtown businesses. And when the firefighters arrived, they claimed that snipers were shooting at them. At the time, 9 African-American men and 1 white woman were arrested, tried, and convicted of arson and conspiracy to fire upon firemen and police officers. The Wilmington 10 were sentenced to a combined 282 years in prison. And several years after the trial, 3 prosecution witnesses recanted, and the case went to appeal to the Fourth Circuit, which found pretrial misconduct. You, as the state's attorney general, could have appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court that decision, but chose not to. Why?
Michael, I caught a lot of hell over that decision, even from the Supreme Court justice herself. Justice Susie Sharp saw me in the hall one day where we shared quarters in the Justice Building. She said, "What's gotten into you, Rufus? You better appeal that thing." Well, I was so tired of hearing national news say that North Carolina was bereft of any kind of justice for the Wilmington 10. The national news was tearing us up, saying that that it was almost like a barbarian state where they were chucking people in jail for things that didn't occur. And the Court of Appeals decision was so precise in saying that there had been all kinds of injustices that I did not know how the Wilmington 10 could get a fair trial. And so I took the, I thought, rather brazen step of just saying, I will not appeal it. And, of course, the people in Wilmington were furious with me. A lot of the members of the House and the Senate were furious because a couple of them had owned some buildings that had been burned down. As I said, the Chief Justice was aggravated with me. And law enforcement in general was sort of mad about it. But I just decided that we're going to stop this thing right here, right now, and I'm glad I did.
You write that in 2012, Governor Bev Perdue issued the Wilmington 10 a pardon of innocence, indicating that they were not guilty of the charges. Do you think that was the right thing to do?
I don't think I would have issued a pardon with that commutation, because I think from all that I can gather from SBI records, from personal interviews, they did shoot. There were some attempts on the lives of SBI agents. And I don't think that it should have been a pardon with innocence, because I don't think the Wilmington 10 were innocent.
Okay. It seems like the current Attorney General of North Carolina, Josh Stein, a Democrat, has been involved in a lot of high-profile things in his brief time in office, such as suing the president, joining other AGs, and opposing the president. Has the job of Attorney General for a state changed since your time?
Not dramatically. In my opinion, it's changed for the worse, because the legislature has gutted the Attorney General's office.
How so?
Well, it took it away from the Attorney General. It took the SBI away from the Attorney General's office, which was a great component. It cut the Attorney General's budget dramatically. He almost had to shut down some phases of the office. But on the other hand, the attorneys general since my day have banded together to do so many more things. Like they took on big tobacco. And by the way, with full record disclosure here, I lobby for Philip Morris. Mm-hmm. And they took on big tobacco and won. And so I'll just say this, when the attorneys general as a body get on you, you better watch out, and businesses should be aware that they are there. And so it has taken on a bigger role. And I know this, that with Attorney General Josh Stein, that he has a brilliant group of people over there who do a fantastic job. And they know how to work with other attorneys general. We didn't do as much of that back in my day. It was just sort of you on your own, go get them. I remember I joined up one time with a suit to sue General Motors over a silly thing at the time, it seemed to be, but wasn't to some people. They sold a Oldsmobile and said it had a Rocket 88 engine. You're too young to remember that, Michael. But an Oldsmobile had a Rocket 88 engine. Well, when they found out that it was a General Motors engine number 2 rather than a Rocket 88 engine, people went nuts, because they wanted their Rocket 88 engine. So I sued General Motors with a number of other attorneys general, and I'll be dogged if we didn't get back people that owned a car with a General Motors engine number 2 rather than a Rocket 88 engine, about $700 a piece. And occasionally I'll have some old lady walk up to me and say, "Well, Rufus, I still remember when you got me back my money for the Rocket 88 engine that I was supposed to have and didn't get." So the Attorney General's office is one that should never be appointed, in my opinion. It should always remain elected and independent, as well as should the auditor's office be. There are certain pushes at time, you know, to say that we should do away with the Council of State seats. Well, I don't really think so.
Okay.
Some of them make no sense, of course. One of the things that we have, Michael, that has always baffled everybody and baffled me when I was Attorney General and running for governor, is the state of education, of who's in charge of education.
Right.
I mean, I don't care who the governor is. The governor is always going to have a big part in education. You're going to have the state superintendent of public instruction. You're going to have the legislature. And the education needs to have somebody who's boss, but we've never had that before in North Carolina, and I don't know how you conquer it unless you do away with electing a superintendent of public instruction, and I don't favor doing away with the election of any public officials that we currently have.
Okay. With your 1984 gubernatorial campaign against Republican Jim Martin, you were on the ballot with Walter Mondale, who was the presidential nominee and a very liberal Democrat. Did you have to walk a tightrope as one of the leading North Carolina Democrats at a time when a strident liberal was the party's national standard bearer?
And Michael, don't forget Geraldine Ferraro. I mean, you got
was the vice presidential candidate.
Yeah, yeah, you got a double whammy. Whammy there with Geraldine Ferraro on the ticket. It wasn't, most of us were, when we found out that they were going to be in some part of the state, we'd be in the totally opposite part of the state. One time, I remember Mondale was in Wilmington, and I was in the highlands of Asheville, North Carolina.
On the other side of the state.
About as far away as I could get.
Right.
But it's never really good to run from those things. It's just part of it. I remember Senator Irvin was down there campaigning for Mondale. Mondale, and this is not to say that Mondale wasn't a very decent person. In fact, George McGovern was one of the nicest people personally you've ever met, and everybody always wanted to condemn him as such a wild, crazy liberal. These people are human beings. It's just that North Carolina, over the years, has become much more conservative. And I don't know what to call my state now. It's purplish.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard you opine on that on talk shows before, but it a lot of it depends on who's running and how strong they are.
Was the party united in 1984? I mean, you had at the same time Jesse Helms being challenged by Jim Hunt. Was there just too much?
No, it was not united. You had my folks and Jim Hunt's folks, and a lot of times they didn't get along very well. I hate to say that. And I had been through a terrible, terrible, divisive primary. When we were running in the beginning in the Democratic primary, there were about 10 of us all together, including a member of the Ku Klux Klan and all kinds of other clowns. And it was started out being very derisive and ended up being very derisive.
We're going to pick up with his 1984 gubernatorial campaign. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer. It's Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins, and we're talking with Rufus Edmiston, the former North Carolina Attorney General and Secretary of State and longtime observer of the state's politics, about his new book, That's Rufus, a memoir of Tar Heel politics, Watergate, and public life. Before the break, you were talking about your gubernatorial campaign, and I hated to cut you off, but you wrote about that campaign that you did not necessarily enjoy running for governor, and that you weren't the, quote, happy warrior during that race. What was it about that campaign that really kind of turned you against the politics of the state?
We were getting into the gotcha era.
Okay.
And that was, if you wake up every day, Michael, and you say, oh my God, what are they coming at me with today? And not that I didn't have a lot of things in my background that you could come at me today. I mean, they would be scrutinizing how well I milked my cow. Did I do that the right way or not? And I simply, you had people fawning over you the whole time, and people just overtly seeking you to say that you're going to point them to a certain position. Everybody used to always describe me as a happy warrior campaigner. Well, I love being attorney general. I loved campaigning for Secretary of State. Mm. In the gubernatorial thing, it was just mammoth after mammoth sort of needless forums with 10 people, as I said, including the Ku Klux Klan person.
Yeah.
And it went on and on and on, and then we had a bitter primary between me and Eddie Knox, had to have a runoff primary. And then, as you know, Eddie Knox came out for Ronald Reagan, mm-hmm. came out for Jesse Helms, and came out against me in the general election. And it just complicated things. And Ronald Reagan ran so heavily in this state. I don't know. I have often said that if I had $20 million more dollars, I don't think I could have won. I don't think Jim Hunt could have won. It was just such a crushing tide from the top with Ronald Reagan over Mondale.
Right.
That I don't know how. Getting through the primary was rough enough, and I never got over being bruised up in the primary. That's to tell the truth about it.
Okay. Not to pile on, but during the general campaign, you had also what John Shelton Reed once described as a barbecue faux pas, which required you to hold a press conference professing your love of the state's barbecue. What happened?
Oh, my goodness. I was out one night at the faculty club at NC State University, and I remember the North Carolina Recreation Association was meeting there, and after it was over, somebody said, "You been getting enough barbecue to eat, Rufus?" I said, "Well, matter of fact, I've eaten so much of the stuff, I wish I'd never see another drop as long as I live." Well, you know, it's obvious that the devil made me say that.
Obviously.
It's obviously. And I was joking, but the next day, my campaign chair, fundraiser, Wilbur Shirley of Wilbur's Barbecue in Goldsboro, called up and said, "What in the world is wrong with you?" In an O, the News and Observer said, "Edmiston attacks barbecue." Well, you know, it no longer got to be a joke. I thought, look, I was only kidding. So I held a press conference and I said, "Look, I have made a drastic mistake and I've gone to an exorcist. And I have had regular sessions and I have been exorcised of this demonic notion I had about barbecue. And I promise I will never do that again. And I'm back on barbecue 3 times a day. So my advice to anybody running for public office in North Carolina, don't mess with barbecue.
And don't pick a side in terms of the sauces, right?
Don't pick a fight in terms of east, west, or sauces. It won't work. And I love barbecue. I even want people to know that because it's just funny. Pick up any barbecue book in North Carolina, go to the index and look up my name, and it'll say things like, "There was this guy, stupid as he could be, named Rufus Edmiston, who said ugly things about barbecue, and guess what? He didn't get to be governor.
He lost.
I enjoy that little thing.
When Senator Ervin wrote in his 1980 book, The Whole Truth, The Watergate Conspiracy, he believed that President Nixon had committed 13 offenses, including alleging that, quote, "the press were venomous machinations of a hostile and unreliable press bent on destroying the country's confidence in a great and good president." When you hear President Trump declare the press to be the enemy of the people, does it feel like we're reliving history again?
In so many ways, especially that one. I think he repeats that at least once a week, that the press is the enemy of the people. Well, when they're after you, that's what you think, but you cannot exist without a free press. And when the day when the press is no longer free in this country, we've lost democracy. And Ervin knew that. He knew that there would always be conflict between the executive and the legislative and judicial branches. But he knew that the Founding Fathers were wise when they separated them. Now, just the other day, our president said that I'm under Article 2, I can do anything I want to do. Well, that's not so. President Nixon thought he could do that and said it, as we mentioned on David Frost's show, that if it's not illegal if the president does it. That's just not so, because so many of the things that Nixon was indicted on during the impeachment proceedings, which didn't have to go forward, they were very things that he did that he thought he could do that he couldn't do. And the Supreme Court, with a unanimous decision, said, "Mr. President, you are not above the law." With the eight, there was one Supreme Court justice who recused himself. in an 8-0 decision, demanding that Nixon turn over the tapes, the Supreme Court said there are things that the president cannot do, and one of them is refuse a lawful subpoena from a co-equal branch of the government.
In today's politics, the U.S. Justice Department has an informal rule and policy that bars a sitting president from being indicted. You served as the state's chief law enforcement officer. How do you view that policy, and what do you think, should it be scrapped, as some Democrats have called for it, and that a sitting president could be indicted?
Well, obviously, this doesn't work that way on the state level. You have several chief executives and statewide officials indicted and convicted every day of every year. On the federal level, I have a notion that what if you had every little district attorney in the nation decide they wanted to take a shot at the president? You would never have anything done. The president would be nothing but in court. And I don't like the notion, but it's not law. It's Justice Department edict. Now, I think that should be tested sometime, although I don't think that I think it's a pretty good edict, but there's nothing in the Constitution anywhere that says anything about that, except that it does talk about impeachment and conviction. And that certainly is not in any singular way that's the only way that you can get rid of a president or hold a president to the rule of law. And so I don't know where that I want to do some research on that edict and find out when it started and just what the reasons were. But I do believe that it would be so disruptive that you couldn't have a president operate if you did not have something like that.
Many folks have described North Carolina as a center-right or center-leaning right state. As we talked about previously, many folks describe this as a purplish-hued kind of a state. You grew up in rural North Carolina, and one of the great divides nowadays feels like it's the urban versus rural division. How do you see that playing out in today's politics in North Carolina?
Well, back when I grew up, of course, you had Republicans and Democrats in the mountains, and we were all very much alike. You couldn't tell the difference between one party and the other in the early years of the 40s and 50s and 60s in the mountains of North Carolina. I noticed something, too, when I each year that NC Spin, a program that I appear on quite a bit, we spoke last year to the Future Farmers of America. Young people and I'm a member, was the president of my club back home. They sort of represent rural North Carolina, and they were very, very pro-Republican in the Future Farmers of America. And I think that there's a notion out there that the cities have brought in all kinds of folks from all over the country, too much diversity, and a rural America sees themselves shrinking up, and it's sort of a be on my guard atmosphere in the rural areas that we're losing our way of life, and I can see how it's threatening to them, and I'm afraid it's going to be that way. But
is there any way to bridge that? Is there any way to speak to rural North Carolinians and say, you know, what is happening in urban areas isn't necessarily a bad thing for you in the rural areas?
I don't know how you really do that, because it is just such – I go to different meetings and I see the rural people gathered in one part of the room even. I see the suburban and city folks in another part of the room. It's just now so stratified that I don't know how you do it, except the great healer is the – economics. If the two are dependent on one another, and that is the only thing I know, is to try to convince both sides that they have something to offer the other side to make things a little bit more commodious.
There are over 20 Democrats seeking your party's nomination for president. What's your take on the 2020 field, and how can they appeal to North Carolinians when the primary comes up on Super Tuesday next March?
Well, it's going to be a new thing for North Carolina, to being the super primary, of course. And I'm glad we're doing that to have more profile. North Carolina used to never count much in these Democratic and Republican primaries, but it sure is on the map now. There is such a hodgepodge of different people running for different things from different notions that I think North Carolina is going to go for the more familiar. I would think that North Carolina would go pretty heavily for Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. He's a known factor. I remember him from my days with Senator Ervin in the Senate when he was just a young fellow like I was. He's very practical, very down to earth, seems to understand the rural-urban divide. I'm not making a campaign speech for Joe Biden, but I'm just saying what I think North Carolina will do. And, of course, it will be overwhelmingly for President Trump.
Okay. One of the key lessons that you learned from Watergate that you write in your book is that, quote, democracy is in peril when a handful of individuals who hold most of the wealth in the nation use that wealth and the power it confers to advance their own political agendas with little or no concern for the public good. Are we in that same time period now with a significant gulf between the haves and have-nots?
Michael, I think we're there. We're well into the belly of that beast. when you boil it down, if you're running for president of either party, and you can find some wealthy donor, they can get you enough name recognition that you can sort of get to be known. Fortunately, it appears though on the Democratic side that most of the folks are getting small contributions. But this plague impacts both parties. I think one of the worst decisions ever handed down was Citizens United. There's nothing uniting about it. It has caused more mischief in the things that follow it than any other one thing I know of, to take away an individual's right to have an impact on elections. And until there can be a constitutional amendment to do something about Citizens United, then we will continue to have the rich running the electoral process. But sometimes people just blow up and don't take it, which I love to see.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You write that, quote, someone once said that politics is the art of humanizing people. Is that what we're missing in today's environment, and what will it take to get us back to that ideal?
I think it was maybe Aristotle. I just don't remember. But We started out with the fact that we are dehumanizing in the process right now, and I think Michael, the key word is empathy. We have to get people thinking more empathetically about other people. I've tried my best to listen to the other side. I know that in your profession as a professor, mm-hmm. you hear every side, and that's what your calling is, to hear every side and let people make an intelligent decision. Sure. And so I think we got to practice more empathy, and it all depends on the individual, because the political consultants are not going to let us if they can help it.
In our last 30 seconds, what would be a key lesson or two lessons for any future politicians in the state of North Carolina to think about from your experience?
Do not let hubris overtake you. Hubris is the old Greek word about you think you're better than everybody else. It gets you in trouble every time. Stay well grounded and keep having empathy for people, and you'll be all right.
Any other words of wisdom from a lifetime in politics?
Other words of wisdom is don't take sides on barbecue.
So we'll keep the barbecue debate at a minimum in North Carolina politics. That's Rufus Edmiston. He's the author of That's Rufus, a memoir of Tar Heel politics, Watergate, and public life. Thank you for your public service to the state of North Carolina and to the country, and enjoyed having you on Charlotte Talks.
Thank you, Michael. A pleasure.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.